So we're going to do the novel and globalization, another one of these spectacularly long, general, abstract titles, but nonetheless, let's see what we do. But before I launch into it, let me say three announcements, right? One is global, the other two are kind of local. So the global one is that we, on the website for the European novel, there, for some reason, I don't know why, I mean, I didn't set it up, and they've shifted it to a series of downloadable Word documents for information to do with bibliographies and stuff. On the lecture list, there's a wrong date printed for the revision lectures. It gives them as on the Thursdays of week one and two in the summer term, next term. They're not on the Thursdays. They're just at exactly the same time on the Wednesday. Okay? In week one, there will be a revision lecture, and that will largely be me going through three passages in the way that I would attack passages in the exam that you're going to get. It's not the passages, obviously, from the exam, but you'll see tips and strategies and means, if you like, to combat and deal with section A in the first revisions lecture. The following Wednesday, not the Thursday, so tell all your friends, right? The following Wednesday will be maybe a wee bit more of a runoff of that, depending on how much we cover in week one. And then, obviously, material to deal with section two in the exam. And a kind of concluding caucus-type lecture where you can, we'll just basically open the floor and we can you can ask questions, okay? To do with the exam, the course, and so on. So the two revision lectures are on the Wednesdays. The second point is for anyone that's in my seminar groups. Tomorrow is the leopard. It's just reminding you that, right? The leopard. That's it. Maybe some of you might have read it by that stage, right? The third one is, if you think the novel and globalization is funky, right, those of you that are second years, there's a course called, this is shameless this time, right, there's a course called The Global Novel, capital T, capital G, capital N, in year three. Sorry, not in year three. It's running as an option next year for years two and three, but none of you are going to be here. If you're in year three, you're going to go away. You get my point, right? So that'll be up and running. So look for that on the module lists. And it's open to everyone, not just the World Lit Pathway people, everyone. It's taught by two mugs called Mukherjee and McDonald, all right? So the novel and globalization. I guess this is really the kind of second lecture in an unofficial trilogy. Began with Pablo last week on his lecture on the other Europe. We're really moving at great speed towards the end of the course, obviously. And we're trying to introduce and shore up, I guess, some of the things that we've already been talking about, but also the question of where Europe and the novel is in relation to quite a lot of the kind of discussion that's came out in the last 10 years or so about the question of world literature within or against globalization. This thing this large conceptual thing we know, or perhaps we don't know enough about, of globalization, or perhaps we have too many definitions of it, and that's going to be part of the problem in some respect. So in a sense, what I'm going to be talking about today is the way that all novels in some sort of sense are global, and we're obviously going to look at the Atom Station in relation to that. How we do so is what I'm going to try and attack, but in order to get there, we first have to come up against what is presently defined as the question or concept, or even theory, if you like, of globalization. Not just in relation to culture, but also in relation to larger questions of political economy and of world government and administration and so on and so forth. Okay? I guess we've got to make a distinction, and it's a connectable one. It's not two separate areas, between the question of globalization in literature, so how we find and elicit forms of the global in the novels that we've read, which are there, some unglobalized as such critically, and some obviously so, and the globalization of literature. So the globalization of the means of literary production, for example, and I mean, you know, a very simple example of that might just be the reading of The Atom Station in a course in Warwick, and a course in New York, and in a course in Mumbai, right? Or the printing of The Atom Station in English, in a bookshop in Coventry, in a bookshop in New York, in a bookshop in Mumbai, or by publishers, if you like, of various novels, the world literary circuit, effectively. But something larger than that, the globalization of culture, which is to do with the question of how the first instance of globalization flattens everything. This is the kind of recognizable abstract thing that we now know as globalization, right? That we all somewhat do the same thing. Those of you that are typing on Twitter just now or Facebook will have already an experience of that, right? I mean, like, you're doing it. You're cutting into what is a global cultural phenomenon, as much, of course, as a global economic one. Now, we're going to think about the question of the globalization of culture in relation to the way that it affects novels and novel writing and the form of the European stroke world novel next week. And there's no reason why this lecture, which is largely to do with the globalization in literature, will not bleed somewhat a little bit into next week's too. It depends how far I go, right? I'm going to set up pretty much the question of globalization, draw out the concepts of it, talk about the argument and debates about it in the first half, next 20 minutes or so. And then we'll look at some novels that we've already seen and read in relation to that. And then in the second half, we're going to really devote to the Atom Station in relation to a lot of these issues. I have a specific thing to say about Ugla, the character of Ugla, in relation to both globalization in lit and the globalization of lit stroke culture. And it may be that next week's lecture, I begin with that. It may be, depending on how much time I've got, that this week's lecture will finish with that. Okay, but we'll see how far we get. So, globalization, very much a disputed term, right? How do we measure it? How do we say something is globalized? Why has it become such an enormous issue that seems unavoidable? It washes across disciplines, across media, and across pretty much all of the kind of political discussions that we seem to have at this moment in time on the planet. The question is, for how long has this done so, recognized under the term or rubric of the thing that we now know of as globalization? When we say global, do we truly mean global, for example? Do we have to make a distinction between that and which we call world? I mean, there's an example of a distinction to be drawn, for example, between people who make a world that's not quite global. So, for example, people who are writing a European novel and writing about it in, say, the 19th century, we'd obviously be thinking about that as a whole world in literature. But let's decrease the magnification of that region, even nation. I mean, there's no reason why one couldn't see, for example, village fiction, a key generic sub-theme of the novel in the early 19th century, as an example of a world writ large, recognized or unrecognized as such. Yeah? This is what Edward Said calls contrapuntal reading. The question that we're, you know, very much localized, ultra-local people who don't really see beyond the hedge, right, to use that criticism of Jane Austen's novels, who don't really see beyond the hedge and are therefore unaware of the larger circuits of the world as it conditions their own local circumstances, we can still globalize that locality by widening our purview. That's one way to think about it. So whether it's unconscious or conscious globalization, there's an issue here. The characters in the novels that we've been looking at gradually increase their cognitive maps of the world around them. They start to work out where their spatial coordinates are, how that's conditioned by larger geographies. So, for example, I mean, it happens in just about every novel that you can read, I guarantee you. But, see, let's take a novel from the global novel, right? A fantastic new court. No, let's take a novel. Haldor Laxness, another novel by Laxness called Independent People. Yeah? Slightly different from The Atom Station, but a novel about sheep, right? With one guy in it for about 150 pages. It's really good. Take the global novel, you'll read it. It's magic, right? There's long discourses about sheep diseases. You'll find a lot about sheep husbandry if you read this book, as much as a lot of other things. Now, that happens for a reason, because the novel's about the periphery of Iceland, about shepherds in Iceland. Not even about in what we might expect to be, the scene in Reykjavik, or even the scene in a village. It happens in one croft on a very peripheral valley. Now, something happens called the First World War. The farmers know nothing of it, nothing. The shepherds who own subsistence farmers locally know nothing about it until they go to the market 2 months after the war begins, because Iceland isn't in the war, the First World War, that is. They go to the market 2 months after the war begins, and suddenly sheep prices have went through the roof, because theirs is an open market to wool for all around the world, right? So is that an instance of the global, not economy, but a global historical event impinging upon a locality, unaware, if you like, of the larger circuits of the war and the world system? Yes, it is. Okay? It's one small instance of the way that globalization is unrecognized but becomes recognized as part of a function of the novel form. Now, historically, so we have this kind of thing about to do with mapping, but historically too, there's an argument. When does the concept begin? When does it emerge? This is very much a dispute, and it's unresolved. So the term itself really just comes into kind of like critical discourse after maybe 1989. A key date, of course, as you all know, right, for the collapse of the Berlin Wall, but largely the ascent of a particular form of free market capitalism into the last bastions, if you like, the larger bastions of the world territories, hitherto uncapitalized in that particular means of the economy. And since then, of course, we see a much larger universalization of the means of production and labor rights and so on and so forth, and also the rule of the commodity in much more territories of the earth, of the same commodity, in much more territories of the earth than hitherto had actually ever appeared. So we were suddenly always globalized at that point. So globalization becomes much more of a kind of feature of every discipline. So there's an argument in a sense that it only really extends from about 1989, where we have the technology to deal with it, right, to understand and make things global. A counter-argument to that would say that, in fact, it's to do with the world revolutions of 1968, which make everyone much more aware of the dissemination of an argument and a revolutionary fervor, if you like, against particular, the drive, if you like, of capital in the world system at a particular moment in time. So people are, the kind of cultural, if you like, firecracker of 1968 begins in one or two countries and spreads virally around the world. That's an instance, if you like, of globalization. Okay, maybe that's a possibility. And of course, we see the same thing in a kind of like rise and spread of a counterculture at the same time in 68 as mass media is really kicking into gear and finding its feet in the world, around the world. Now, remember, every time I say world or global in this lecture, you should be cynical and skeptical of the pure geographic reach of that term. That's key. You need to hold that in tension somehow. Because, of course, if we can go all the way back to someone like Marx, for example, in the Communist Manifesto, who says at some point capital will spread its arms all the way around the globe. That's the logic, if you like, of capitalism. At some point, the world will be global. Whether or not that has happened, or is close to happening, of course, is still a disputed point. But there's no question that it has advanced in the contemporaneous moment much more than it ever had done, even in the 19th century, when we're really just looking at empires in particular distinct and discrete territories of the globe. But the ambition was always global. Now, having said that, 68, 89, what about 1580? Right? What about maybe 1848? Other distinct moments at which we can see the world expanding and affecting localities without them in some respects being able to fight back. I mean, a lot of the element of the core periphery circuits of this concept of globalization, we can see in novels. We can see in the Village novel, for example, a common theme of which is things from the outside interfering with the events and forms of the village, of local culture. Those of you that have read The Atom Station will know what I'm talking about by now. We can see the kind of circuits of the village novel from the early 19th century in what happens in Laxness's novel. But certainly, from, say, around 1560 to 1580, the advent of that long wash that we now know as the phenomenon of modernity, we can say that trade relations begin in the Mediterranean littoral, in the West Asian area, right, with North Africa, that are the beginnings of an international or transnational sense of world or international culture, certainly. Whether or not, again, it's global or not, I don't know. But at some point, very soon, there's a guy called Columbus who's going to move, right? He's done that thing about going to the Americas and opening up vast new territories of the world to be exploited. So the question of whether or not globalization is actually just another contemporary word or a new avatar of a longer process of modernity as we know it is the discussion in a kernelized form. Now, of course, our course hasn't really kind of extended that long. We've really been looking at the period, I guess, of empire and imperialism as it really kind of kicks in from the late 18th century all the way through to the 1950s, 1960s, right up to a phenomenal global, truly global conflict in World War II, and the beginning of another larger, Cold War. And Laxness's novel sits right in the middle of those later two events, published in 1948, about riots and a protest in Iceland at the setting up of a US Marine base as part of the strategy for the oncoming Cold War in 1946. So what I'm really saying in a long, circuitous discussion about it is the fact that it's a disputed term, and rightly so, but only in order, we need to understand the dispute in some respects to understand the way that the phenomenon works in the novels and in the events in the novels, okay? And we'll see next week how the phenomenon changes and affects the novel form as it travels from territory to territory. We've already seen this in some respects, of course, with our comparative ambit on the novel, on the course, on the module that we've been doing. But that happens on a much larger scale in the 20th century, again, arguably. So, definitions are always, in a sense, cumbersome and even almost abstract as to seem rather ridiculous or obvious. Look at, for example, Martin Albrow's. He says that globalization is making or being made global, right, in individual instances, by the act of dissemination of practices, values, technology, other human products throughout the globe, when global practices and so on exercise an increasing influence, I should say, over people's life. Well, it's at the end. When the globe serves as a focus for our premise in shaping human activities, and incremental change occasioned by the interaction of such instances, seen as the generality of such instances, and such instances being viewed abstractly. So individual moments need to be abstracted and generalized as part of a larger phenomenon. Now note the tension in Albrow's definition, a very important one, between making or being made global. Between making or being made global. And of course, we see this tension in the Atom Station. People are shouting about the country being sold against their wills, against their wishes. People are arguing that they want Iceland to remain Icelandic. And of course, the position of the nation and national culture within globalization, between local and global pins, is key. It's crucial. So what makes the global truly global is another question. Who makes us global? What makes us global? Can be pursued, obviously, in Laxness, but I would suggest in quite a lot of the other novels that we've looked at. So, we see this worry and also argument for parochialism. minute, 1 minute.